This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
And welcome to yet another session of the Festival of Ideas. My name is Rick Saar. I teach law at the University of South Australia, and it's my pleasure to be your chairperson and kind of master of ceremonies for this session. I've just been talking to our stage manager, Melanie Selwood, who will be with the roving mic before we finish today, just about the program and something of a slight discrepancy in timing. The program, where it actually has a nice picture of Alex, does say here 11:45, which is kind of now, to 1:15, which is a long session. If you go to the actual program at the front, where it actually has today's program hour by hour, it says 11:45 to 12:30, which is 45 minutes shorter. In chatting with Melanie, because the program will need to keep moving fairly rapidly after that, we are going to go with this program rather than with this program to allow you to see some more things. However, because we are starting 5 minutes late, I think we can crib until 12:35. So if that's not of too much difficulty to anyone, we will ask Alex to speak for around about 25 minutes. I'll make a quick introduction. The less you hear of me, the more you hear of him. And then after 25 minutes, he and I will be in dialogue around these chairs, and you'll have an opportunity to ask some questions as well. So our time frame will be to walk out of here at precisely 12:35 today, if you can think around your program thereafter, you know, the front of the line at the sausage sizzle or whatever you need to do thereafter. Anyway, it falls to me with the very great privilege and pleasure of welcoming Dr. Alex Wodak. As you can see here in your brief, he has been the director of the Alcohol and Drug Service at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney since 1982, and obviously there for more than 25 or 6 years in health policy and public policy. He has a major interest in prevention of HIV among injecting drug users and drug policy reform. Alex is president of the Australian Drug Law Reform Foundation and was president of the International Harm Reduction Association from 1996 to 2004. He helped establish the first needle syringe program and the first medically supervised injecting centre in Australia when both were pre-legal, and often works in developing countries on HIV control among injecting drug users. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Alex Wodak.
Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm going to be talking about the first and last century of global drug prohibition. We're going to start off talking a little bit about the history and development of global drug prohibition. Global drug prohibition developed from a meeting of 13 nations known as the International Opium Commission, which was a meeting convened by the United States and held in Shanghai 100 years ago in February 1909. Subsequent meetings included one held in The Hague in 1912 and then another meeting, the Second International Opium Commission, which was held in Geneva in 1925 under the aegis of the League of Nations. The Geneva meeting agreed to prohibit 3 plant-based drugs, opium, coca and cannabis, and drugs derived from them. After the Second World War, 3 international drug treaties were negotiated and agreed. The Single Convention, brought together in one treaty in 1961, all the treaties agreed under the League of Nations. The Psychotropic Convention in 1971 was a response to growing fears about synthetic drugs such as amphetamine and barbiturates. A third treaty on drug trafficking was agreed in 1988. The United Nations established several organisations to support these treaties. The Commission on Narcotic Drugs, CND, develops policy. The Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, implements policy, while a quasi-UN body, the International Narcotics Control Board, the INCB, monitors compliance by parties, that is, member states, with the agreed policies. A remarkable feature of international control, drug control, is the virtually universal adoption of this system by almost every member of the United Nations. A further important development was the declaration of a war against drugs by President Nixon on the 17th of June 1971. While intended originally only as a political strategy and not as a public policy...
Things underneath.
Oh, I see. I beg your pardon.
It's okay.
While Well, originally intended only as a political strategy and not a public policy, that distinction was soon forgotten. The extraordinary political success of the war on drugs in the United States was noted and emulated widely across the world. On the 5th of June 1981, a US publication reported the recognition of a new immune disorder, later termed AIDS, and subsequently shown to be caused by a virus which came to be called HIV. Injecting drug users were found to be at high risk of acquiring this virus and subsequently transmitting it to others. Today, about 30% of new HIV infections outside sub-Saharan Africa are associated with injecting drug use, and AIDS today accounts for one in every six deaths in the world. Although effective harm reduction methods of preventing HIV infection among injecting drug users have been known for about two decades, adoption and implementation is poor, largely because of entrenched opposition from drug law enforcement supporters. The aims of global drug prohibition are firstly to minimise the availability and use of specified prohibited drugs for recreational purposes, and secondly to ensure that adequate supplies of these prohibited drugs are still available for medicinal and scientific purposes. The indicators that drug prohibition is working are firstly the scarcity of prohibited drugs, secondly high and increasing prices and low and decreasing prices of street drugs, thirdly, declining consumption of illicit drugs, and fourthly, that the identified benefits of prohibition far exceed the unintended adverse effects of the policy. Has drug prohibition worked? Well, drugs, ladies and gentlemen, are still readily available. Prices have fallen dramatically, not risen, and purity has been increasing, not decreasing, and I'll show you data for all of this. Production and consumption of illicit drugs is increasing, not decreasing. While benefits of global drug prohibition are hard to identify, adverse effects are multiple, severe, serious, and obvious. If this is success, what on earth would failure look like? In 1998, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime attended a major drug policy meeting at the United Nations in New York and used the slogan, "A drug-free world, we can do it." 10 years later, in 2007, according to UNODC's own official estimates, global opium production had more than doubled, and the 1998 and 2007 figures circled by the red rectangles showed that global opium production had more than doubled. In fact, it increased by 103%. Cocaine production, the same period, again identified by the red rectangles, had increased by 20%, and cannabis production, global cannabis production, had increased in the first 6 years of that decade by 36%. If this is success, what would failure look like? Illicit drugs are also readily available. Here we have figures for the availability of heroin in Australia, these are official figures, from 2000 to 2008. And as you can see here, that 60 to 85% of illicit drug users reported that heroin was either easy or very easy, shown in the easy is the dark blue, very easy is the pale blue, that 60 to 85% of Australian drug users reported that heroin was easy or very easy to obtain between 2000 and 2008. Last year's figures were 85% said that heroin was easy or very easy to obtain. Here we have the figures for cocaine. From 2001, 40 to 60% said that cocaine was easy or very easy to obtain. And here we have the figures for methamphetamine. And from 2002, 80% reported that methamphetamine powder was either easy or very easy to obtain. If this is success, what would failure look like? In a recent study of the heroin and cocaine market from 1981 to 2002, commissioned by the European Commission, Peter Reuter and Franz Trautmann reported that global drug prices for heroin and cocaine fell by more than 80% in those two decades. Here are figures from the United States Drug Enforcement Agency, who reported that a unit of heroin, the top left, which had cost $3.90 per unit in 1980, cost just bottom left on yours now, had cost just 80 cents in 1999, while Purity on the right side of the screen rose from 3.6% in 1980 to 38.2% in 1999. In the European Union, between 2001 and 2006, the price of seven drugs decreased from 10% to up to 50%. Here are the retail prices in Europe and the United States. United States is the dark blue bar. Europe is the pink magenta bar line. Declined, as you can see, substantially between 1990 and 2005. Similar figures for cocaine with the same colour coding, and you can see the substantial drop in prices. As the number of jail and prison inmates serving sentences for drug-related offences increased tenfold in the United States, from a mere 50,000 in 1981 on your left to 500,000 in 2003, the price of heroin and cocaine, cocaine in the dark, heroin in the pale grey, dropped by about 80%. Same period as the USA increased its spending on international drug control, more than tenfold in the same period, the price of heroin and cocaine again dropped 80%. If this is success, what would failure look like? The availability of prohibited drugs for medicinal use has been inadequate. Just 15% of the world's population in 1999 accounted for 87% of the global legal morphine consumption. In 1999, the United States accounted for 4.7% of the world's population, but accounted for 49% of legal global morphine consumption and 99% of the consumption of sustained-release oxycodone. Only 10 million of the 20 million new global cancer cases each year are expected to receive adequate pain relief. Have there been benefits of drug prohibition? Of the almost 200 countries that have adopted global drug prohibition for some years now, identifiable benefits of prohibition have been few and far between. The United States experienced a heroin shortage lasting a couple of years in the 1970s when the French Connection was identified and then broken up. After the Mr. Asia Syndicate was detected and dealt with, in the early 1990s, heroin has been in short supply in New Zealand. It helps to keep heroin out of your country if your country's got a small population, an unimpressive economy, and if your country is surrounded by 170 million square kilometres of Pacific Ocean. For diehard supporters of the war on drugs, Sweden is proof that prohibition can be successful. But Sweden lies on the periphery of Europe. It is one of the more rural countries in Europe, and it spends a lot of money on health and welfare. And importantly, Sweden also has less economic inequality than most other developed countries. Some have attributed Australia's heroin shortage since 2000 to drug law enforcement. But our heroin shortage occurred at a time when heroin production in our major source country, Burma, had dropped by 80 to 90%, while consumption in China, a transit country for much of the heroin reaching Australia, had increased tenfold. The heroin shortage that affected other markets supplied by Burma, such as Western Canada and some Southeast Asian countries, also makes the likely role of Australian drug law enforcement in our heroin shortage very questionable. While benefits are hard to identify, serious unintended consequences are all too obvious. The UNODC is the major international defender of global drug prohibition, and this is how this organisation describes the unintended consequences of its drug control policies. Global drug control efforts have had a dramatic unintended consequence, a criminal black market of staggering proportions. Organised crime is a threat to security. Criminal organisations have the power to destabilise society and governments. The illicit drug business is worth billions of dollars a year, part of which is used to corrupt government officials and to poison economies. Drug cartels are spreading violence in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. West Africa is under attack from narco-trafficking. Collusion between insurgents and criminal groups threatens the instability of West Asia, the Andes, and parts of Africa. fueling the trade in smuggled weapons, the plunder of natural resources, and piracy. Can drug prohibition work? If we cannot keep drugs out of our prisons, and we cannot, how can we keep drugs out of Hindley Street? If a kilogram of heroin in Bangkok costs $1,000, but the same kilogram of heroin costs $300,000 in New York, London, Amsterdam, or Adelaide, how can it be stopped from making that journey? The more money we spend on customs and police, and the more severe the prison sentences for drug-related offences, the higher we expect the retail price to be. The higher the price, the more the profit. And the more the profit, the more attractive it is for would-be traffickers to take the risks and bring that kilogram of heroin from Bangkok. This is the Achilles heel of drug law enforcement. If alcohol prohibition failed in the United States from 1920 to 1933, and it did, then how can we expect that drug prohibition is going to be any different? What do experts think? Let's start with expert opinion from Australia. Here is one of the earliest assessments of the failure of drug prohibition in Australia. Edible opium was taxed and available legally in Australia until 1906. In his annual report to the Commonwealth Parliament in 1908 on the state of taxation in the nation, H.N.P. Wollaston, the Commonwealth Comptroller General in Customs, said, "It is very doubtful if such prohibition has lessened to an extent the amount which is brought into Australia. Owing to total prohibition, the price of opium has risen enormously. The Commonwealth gladly gave up about £60,000 revenue with a view to a suppression of the evil, but the result has been not what has been hoped for. What now appears to be the effect of total prohibition is that while we have lost the duty, the opium is still imported pretty freely." The Parliamentary Joint Committee of the National Crime Authority in 1989 said, "All the evidence shows, however, not only that our law enforcement agencies have not succeeded in preventing the supply of illicit drugs to Australian markets, but that it is unrealistic to expect them to do so." Let's look at expert opinion from the United States. This is a quote from George Shultz, the former US Secretary of State, and this quotation was taped when he was speaking without knowledge that he was being taped in 1989. And he said, "It seems to me that we're not really going to get anywhere until we take the criminality out of the drug business and the incentives for criminality out of it. Frankly, the only way I can think of to accomplish this is to make it possible for addicts to buy drugs at some regulated place at a price that approximates their cost. We need at least to consider and examine forms of controlled legalization of drugs." Richard Holbrooke, the current US envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, said earlier this year, "The United States alone is spending $800 million a year on counter-narcotics. We have gotten nothing out of it, nothing. It is the most wasteful and ineffective program I've seen in 40 years. Milton Friedman, winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics, said, "Drugs are a tragedy for addicts, but criminalizing their use converts that tragedy into a disaster for society, for users and for non-users alike. Our experience with the prohibition of drugs is a replay of our experience with the prohibition of alcoholic beverages." In a discussion with President Vicente Fox of Mexico in 2002, President George W. Bush said, "As long as there is a demand for drugs in this country, some crook is gonna..." What he said is going to figure out how to get them here. David Cameron, leader of the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom and a likely future Prime Minister, said in 2005, "Politicians attempt to appeal to the lowest common denominator by posturing with tough policies and calling for crackdown after crackdown. Drug policy has been failing for decades." David Cameron was a member of the Select Committee on Home Affairs of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, which reported in 2002 when the committee said, "If there is any single lesson from the experience of the last 30 years, it is that policies based wholly or mainly on enforcement are destined to fail. It remains an unhappy fact that the best efforts of police and customs have had little, if any, impact on the availability of illegal drugs, and thus this is reflected in the prices on the streets, which are as low as they have ever been. Chris Mullen was the chair of that committee, and he said in 2002, attempts to combat illegal drugs by means of law enforcement have proved so manifestly unsuccessful that it is difficult to argue for the status quo. The strategy unit in Whitehall, United Kingdom, is a research centre available to the British Cabinet, and the Blair Cabinet in 2003 commissioned a confidential report which was later leaked to the public. The strategy unit concluded a sustained seizure rate of over 60% is required to put a successful trafficker out of business. Anecdotal evidence suggests that seizure rates as high as 80% may be needed in some cases. Sustained successful intervention at this scale has never been achieved. The strategy unit also reported, over the past 10 to 15 years, despite interventions at every point in the supply chain, cocaine and heroin consumption have been rising, prices falling, and drugs have continued to reach users. Government interventions against the drug business are a cost of doing business rather than a substantive threat to the industry's viability. And here's a statement from the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, who said on the 7th of May this year, many countries impose criminal sanctions for same-sex sex, commercial sex, and drug injection. Such laws constitute major barriers to reaching key populations with HIV services. These behaviours should be decriminalised, and people addicted to drugs should receive health services for the treatment of their addiction. One of the reasons that the drug policy debate has lasted so long has been the sexing up and the cherry-picking of data. This will be familiar to all of us from the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. In leaked minutes of the War Cabinet meeting in the 10 Downing Street on the 23rd of July 2002, Sir Richard Dearlove, head of MI6, known as C, was reported to have said of US policy making in the United States at that time, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. This is a very familiar situation, unfortunately, in the war against drugs. Why does drug prohibition persist? As H.L. Mencken, the former commentator from the Baltimore Sun, said, the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the population alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. The dilemma we have is that effective drug policies are unpopular, while popular drug policies are often ineffective. The attraction of drug prohibition is that it sounds intuitively as though it ought to work. The attraction of drug law reform is that it is based on evidence, but what makes it hard to advocate for is that it sounds counterintuitive. So the debate about drug law reform is like many other debates, such as the debate about economic protectionism. What are the alternatives? The threshold step is to regard illicit drugs as primarily a health and social issue. Of course, there will always be an important role for drug law enforcement, but drug law enforcement should not be forced to carry almost the entire burden of drug policy. That clearly has only worked in the past as a political strategy and hasn't worked as a public policy. Funding for health and social interventions should be increased to the level of drug law enforcement. To achieve better outcomes, policy must be based on evidence, and policymakers should fund policy options to get the best return on the public investment. Penalties for drug possession and consumption should be reduced to small civil sanctions or preferably eliminated. Treatment of drug users should play a much more important role, and this can only happen if the capacity of the drug treatment system is expanded, its quality is improved, and the range of treatment options is considerably broadened. There are increasing calls for taxation and regulation of cannabis. Cannabis accounts for a considerable proportion of the cash flow associated with illicit drugs, including in Australia, and taking most of that cash flow out of the black market will have considerable benefits. When all or most of these steps have been taken, there may be a small role for allowing the recreational sale, the commercial sale of small quantities of dilute samples of recreational drugs. We should remember that this would not be a new policy, but a return to a former policy. Before 1906 in Australia, as I've mentioned, edible opium was taxed and sold in grocery stores. Before 1913, Coca-Cola contained cocaine. In terms of prevention, we should aim to reduce economic inequality. More unequal communities have more problems with illicit drugs. Conclusions. Global drug prohibition began 100 years ago. It has not achieved its aim of reducing the recreational use of illicit drugs or ensuring that the supply of these drugs for medicinal purposes is adequate. Drug prohibition has failed comprehensively. It cannot be made to work effectively. This is now being increasingly recognised. Political elites have known this for a long time. It has survived because in the past it has been an effective political strategy. The debate about drug policy has been very dishonest. Just as in the Iraq War, data has been sexed up and cherry-picked. There is a recent realisation that drug law reform is now feasible. If we consider the alternatives to current policy, the most important step is to redefine drugs as primarily a health and social problem. There are many terrible ways to use illicit drugs, but the worst way of all is to use illicit drugs for political purposes. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if we can hear, that sounds good on my microphone. Alex has a microphone as well, and I see a number of hands, and we have a roving microphone. I see the first question here. Keep those hands up so I can kind of spy you as we go. I'm ready to be spied. Where we go?
Thank you, Alex, for this very passionate and clear-minded call for reality. It is clear that the call is to, if you like, decriminalize and to regard the use of drugs as a social issue. I'm a neuroscientist, and about 20 years ago I was actually the first director of a National Medical Research Council unit for drug addiction, searching for the cellular basis. And some of us realized immediately that no matter what we would discover, that we wouldn't have any impact in the actual policies. And my question to you is that, do you think that the big difficulty is with the public and the politicians who really have regarded drug use a moral issue and they called it as an evil without any consideration about the actual real harm that the drug may or might not do, and I know enough about it, of the harm they can do, but also the limit of this harm. And this comes from modern studies as a neuroscientist, I know, because I teach that most of these drugs that we call them drugs are really similar to substances that we have in our own brain. And modern research begin to reveal the ways in which we might become addicted to some of them, not all of them, and the potential worst toxic side effects of the use of this drug, but also a very potentially good use of these drugs, which at the moment is prohibited. So the harm is really very hard. How would you go about to step into this area of biological role of these drugs?
Well, thank you. That's a fascinating and very important series of questions. In two parts, you asked about the community attitudes. And there's no doubt the community attitudes are changing. But there's no doubt that also when you look at other areas where social policy is considered, that change takes a long time. The National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People in the United States was established in 1909. Took 100 years from the establishment of the NAACP to the first black president taking office. The argument about the unequal treatment of women in our community, the intellectual debate such as it was over 40 years ago. But we still haven't seen, we've seen some change, but we've seen nowhere near enough. The Wolfenden report into recommending that sexual behaviour between males, females, same-sex couples in private and consenting should not be subject to criminal sanctions. You know, that was in the 50s and 60s, and it took another 40 years before that result went out to civil unions in the United Kingdom, haven't even got to that stage in Australia. So these changes take a long time, and we shouldn't underestimate the fear factor. But it's clear now that in many countries the population is ahead of the politicians. It's the politicians who are really most fearful of dipping their toe into the water. And until recently, they paid a heavy price if they moved in this area. But it's clear that things are changing. Obama campaigned in 2004 for the Senate in Illinois on a ticket, on a list of things which included decriminalization of drugs. He didn't use that in 2008. Obama has said the war on drugs is an utter failure. He said that in the Senate. He said he's in favour of shifting the paradigm to a public health paradigm. So things are moving on, but I think it's a little bit like the paper, scissors and rock game that the children play, and the sort of the three elements we deal with are fear, evidence and rationality, and most of the time fear wins in the short term, but in the long term evidence and rationality does win. In relation to the neuroscience elements, I don't dismiss that work. I think that work is helpful. The more we can understand this difficult problem, the better, and it does give us insight into different ways of treating people with drug and alcohol problems, and that can only be beneficial. We've benefited enormously from things that were made. Just this will be familiar to you, but during the Vietnam War, President Nixon was terrified about the political consequences of so many US servicemen coming back to the United States addicted to heroin, and he gave $1 billion in 1970s money to the National Institute of Health, and out of that was identified the opiate receptor in the brain, and also the system of chemicals that you referred to in the body that are like opium, that allow opium to act on our bodies. And out of that came the drugs naloxone and naltrexone. So there are benefits of basic research, I certainly support it.
Okay, so that the microphone is moving fairly quickly, I'm going to go with the gentleman in the brown shirt. Straight after him will be the woman in the black jacket, the man in the stocking cap, and Dean with his hand up with the piece of paper, and see how we go, because we only have 15 minutes to go. Four quick questions, no speeches, please.
Quick answers.
Thank you. Alex, is it possible for those of us who are interested to get that list of statistics so that we can use it against our politicians, etc.?
Sure.
I'm sure it would be. Where can we get it?
If you write to me, Awodak, Awodak, my first name and surname, at St. Vincent's, STVINCENTS .com .au, Awodak at stvincents.com.au. I'll happily send it to you.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to ask about the international conventions that govern drug policy and do tend towards a prohibition stance and how we can work with that. That's one question. My second one is, who's going to run for cover and who's going to panic if we decriminalize all those drugs tomorrow? So basically, whose interests are served by continued criminalization?
Okay. Well, the conventions are sort of set in stone. When I'm not an international law expert, but when the international law experts look at the treaties, it's common for them to say two things. One is that when they read them superficially, they seem impregnable, like a sort of fortress. But when they look at them more carefully, there are lots of opportunities. For example, the three treaties require the parties, that is member states that have signed up to these treaties, to provide treatment and rehabilitation, and they never define what treatment and rehabilitation constitutes. So there's opportunity for great latitude there. Another important caveat in the whole system is that the treaties say that domestic law and domestic constitutions are dominant over what's contained in the treaties. Another important phenomenon that we should all bear in mind is that when the United Nations was set up in 1945, the three primary objectives were national security, economic development, and human rights. And those are the primary goals of the United Nations system, and the drug commitments are subordinate to those other commitments. So where there's a clash between human rights and drugs, human rights should be dominant. So there, the more you look at it, the more chinks you see. Changing any United Nations international treaty is formidably difficult and takes decades to do. If we were to write a treaty now saying that there should be 7 days in the week and 365 days in the year, and when it's dark will be called night and when it's light will be called day, it'd take decades to get agreement about that. So I wouldn't hold out scrapping the treaties. That'll take centuries. We're stuck with them. But in fact, the truth is, or at least my view is, that almost all the things we would want to do, we can do within the treaties anyway. Your second point is very important. Who wins? Quo bono. And the answer is that drug law enforcement's done very well out of this. Prisons unions have done very well out of this. And just last November, when President Obama was elected, the people of California had a plebiscite that they answered to, and California, the state of California, owes $26 billion. It's bankrupt. And this would have, if passed, would have shifted $1 billion from the prison's budget into drug treatment and would have saved the state of California $2.5 billion a year. And it did very, very well in the opinion polls until the prisons union came out against it. And Governor Schwarzenegger, plus the four previous governors of California, all stood up at a press conference and denounced it. And so that bill lost 60-40 in the plebiscite. It's fairly clear that that the people who are benefiting from drug law enforcement based drug policy are very prominent in the debate to keep things as they are.
Okay, man of the brown shirt.
Two brief questions. First one, why am I paying so much for my drugs? And the second one is...
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
The first question is, why am I paying so much for my drugs, given that all of your graphs were showing the price were dropping?
That's legal drugs.
Illegal ones. And the second one was, do you think that scientists and researchers have a greater role to play in entering the political foray by challenging governments to produce particular policies, but the challenge that those policies lead to the outcomes that the government state? I mean, I know you're doing it now, and that's fantastic. Is there more capacity within science to do that?
I presume you're referring to cannabis. Cannabis is very expensive in Australia. Overall, just for your information, the UNODC has estimated that the turnover of illicit drugs in the world is $322 billion a year. And the strategy unit of the British Cabinet that I mentioned estimated that profit accounts for 26 to 58% of turnover of major drug traffickers in Afghanistan. So one of the reasons that cannabis prices are high in Australia is probably largely due to cannabis law enforcement. But prices dropped a lot in the 1990s when drug law enforcement went down in Australia against cannabis. And also when cannabis production shifted into the indoors, there were huge economies, and that was passed on to the consumer. So cannabis prices dropped about 50% in the 1990s. Kenneth Clements in Western Australia works on that. Now, your second question was... I've been doing this stuff for a quarter of a century, and the evidence really does make a difference. Really makes a huge difference. And you wouldn't notice it from within Australia because that process hasn't started yet. But the process of accepting drug law reform is now really moving rapidly around the world. In February, Governor Schwarzenegger said, let's have a debate about legalising cannabis in California as a way of reducing the debt of the Californian government. We've had three former presidents of Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil in February, coming out saying the war on drugs has failed and calling for this kind of debate. So the arguments are really now starting to bite, and there are many other examples I could give you. Just on Friday, the German Parliament has allowed heroin prescription treatment to be available as a normal part of the medical system in Germany. So things are moving, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States. And what's changing it, what the difference, has been the evidence. The evidence is overwhelming.
Let me just pause here and say we have a question from the woman in the jacket. A man in the stocking cap and Dean Dowling, they're the ones I promised, and I would die if I can't get to them. So nice short questions, please.
Thank you. In light of your comments regarding drug reform and how that's presently viewed internationally, at a recent plenary meeting of the UNODC, an American NGO made some rather positive comments in relation to the removal of drug prohibition, coupled with your comments in relation to Obama's view in relation to it. And given that the United States holds a fairly prominent position in the UNODC and its view in relation to drug reform and drug prohibition, generally my questions are twofold. One, do you see that internationally, if there is a political will internationally, which is perhaps fostered by America in some degree in the UNODC, that would make it much simpler for countries to actually approach drug reform? Secondly, my question is, do you see a role, an active role for NGOs, given that there was an NGO forum at the UNODC that made a political stand in relation to drug prohibition this year?
Yes, the short answer to that is yes and yes. If the United States moves a millimetre on drug policy, the rest of the world can move a metre. And I do a lot of what I do about several months of the year, I travel in mainly in Asia, a little bit in Middle East, Central Asia, South America a bit, in this kind of area, and doing international consultancies and that the like to do with HIV prevention and drug policy. And it's very clear that the United States has extraordinary influence on countries around the world, and a very common question that I get asked when I do these consultancies, why should we do that if the United States is not doing it? Well, the United States is about to start doing it. On February 12th, they released the chargé d'affaires in Vienna. The US chargé d'affaires announced that the US was no longer against harm reduction, which was a major step forward, but he said, but we'd define harm reduction to include needle syringe programs and methadone, and we don't include injecting rooms and heroin trials in harm reduction. So the United States is certainly changing. Your comments about NGOs are very important. I attended the NGO forum in Vienna last July, and there were 300 people from all over the world. How they got there is another question, but China, 1.3 billion, was represented by one person who wasn't even Chinese. New Zealand had 8 people and Australia had 10 people. So let's not question the representativeness too closely. But what was clear at that meeting was that 3/4 of the people in the room had views that were fairly similar to the kind of views that I've indicated, and I suspect many people here today have. And that was the first time UNODC had ever tolerated NGOs taking part in the policy-making process. And it was a very positive experience, and everybody remarked upon it, including many of the UNODC staff. And now the role of civil society in the United Nations is being recognised as something that the whole UN system has to do better at engaging with, and frankly they are. And UNODC is one of the last major UN organisations to accept a role for civil society, but that's changing. So those of you who want to be involved in this from an NGO perspective, I'd urge you to do so. Look, the argument, it's very important we respect different opinions, very important that we base our arguments on evidence, and I hope I've done that this morning and on other occasions. And that's how the debate has to go. And if other people have different views, let's hear their evidence.
Okay, I promised to have you out of here in about 2 or 3 minutes, so we're going to have two short questions, no double-barreled questions. Here's one here.
I believe Portugal has had a massive change in its drug policy. What was the outcome of this, and how has it been taken up in the rest of the EU and the world?
You can see how effective prohibition is. Well, the simple answer is Portugal decriminalised in 2001. I've heard the Portuguese drug policy experts speak at a private meeting, and they said that they looked at what was happening around Europe, and the only countries that made sense were really Netherlands and Switzerland, but why did they introduce such limited reforms? So Portugal went a lot further. And the effects have been very dramatic and very positive, and are being watched widely around Europe and the rest of the world. And earlier this year, there was a very important paper from the Cato Institute, which is a free market, economic, conservative, sort of libertarian think tank in the United States, Cato, C-A-T-O. So if you look it up on the website, you'll find this very important report, packed full with facts and figures, more than I can give you in 10 seconds. But basically, it's been a very positive experience, and other countries are looking at what Portugal's done and wanting to follow what Portugal's done.
Profuse apologies to all those people who had a sea of hands before. Dean's going to give me the last question now.
Yes. The prohibition of drugs is religious, and that's the problem. Now, you can torpedo the lying drug laws by telling the pharmacological truth. Go to Holland and India. Death rates, addiction rates, and so on. And so that's the way to torpedo the drug laws. Tell the public the pharmacological truth. Heroin and cannabis are non-toxic.
Let's have that as a question then, Alex. Are they toxic?
Yes, of course they're toxic. All drugs are toxic, but it's more complicated than that. In medicine, what we look at isn't whether drugs are toxic or not, but we look at the ratio between the benefits and the toxicity. And when heroin is used medicinally, heroin is converted into opium within 60 seconds when it enters the human body. And so heroin is really what we call a pro-drug. It's really morphine. And we use bucket loads of morphine in Australia every year. And the results are enormously beneficial, and the problems exist, but they're relatively minor. There should be a revolution if anyone tries to get rid of morphine from Australian healthcare system. It's a great drug. And heroin, when used medicinally, and this has been shown now in heroin trials in half a dozen countries, when we're using heroin to treat heroin-dependent people, the results similarly are enormously beneficial. We've now had randomised control trials from half a dozen countries, and they've all had very similar results. Benefits far outweighed any negatives.
And in India,
The randomised control trials have been carried out in Switzerland, Netherlands, Germany, Spain, Canada, and now Britain is doing one. And the British one obviously hasn't been reported, but all the others have been published, and they're all very, very favourable.
Let me pause there to say that unfortunately we've come to the end of our time at this most interesting session. The only bit that I can add to it is listening to the comedian Jay Leno some years ago, who said at about the same time Nancy Reagan had this policy of just say no back in the 1980s, he said, as a result of just say no, 10,000 new addicts are being added every hour, and all you've got to do is shut Nancy Reagan up and the whole thing will fall in a hole. That was Jay Leno's view. I also want to point out that this is a massive disconnect and disjunction between public policy and the evidence, and one only has to see particularly the way in which Sandra Kenk was vilified later last year and earlier this year simply for raising some of these issues, which highlights the delicate nature of this particular topic. So we're delighted today that Alex Wodak has, as I think, brought some factual basis back to the debate and highlighting the evidence and highlighting some of the dilemmas associated with the policies that we still continue to endure. It behoves me and you, I think, to keep this debate going. We've been privileged to hear Alex today. Please join me in thanking him once again. Thank you.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.